Mitch asked. They smiled and seemed to appreciate the relief. In about 20 years, said Mr. Lambert. I can wait. How's the BMW? Asked Victor Milligan. Great. It's ready for the 5,000-mile service. Did you get moved in okay? Yes, everything's fine. I appreciate the firm's assistance in everything. You've made us feel very welcome, and Abby and I are extremely grateful. McKnight quit smiling and returned to the legal pad. As I've told you, Mitch, the bar exam has priority. You've got 6 weeks to study for it, and we assist in every way possible. We have our own review courses directed by our members. All areas of the exam will be covered, and your progress will be closely watched by all of us, especially Avery. At least half of each day will be spent on bar review, and most of your spare time as well. No associate in this firm has ever failed the exam. I won't be the first. If you flunk it, we take away the BMW, Tolar said with a slight grin. Your secretary will be a lady named Nina Huff. She's been with the firm more than 8 years. Sort of temperamental, not much to look at, but very capable. She knows a lot of law and has a tendency to give advice, especially to the newer attorneys. It'll be up to you to keep her in place. If you can't get along with her, we'll move her. Where's my office? Second floor, down the hall from Avery. The interior woman will be here this afternoon to pick out the desk and furnishings. As much as possible, follow her advice. Lamar was also on the second floor, and at the moment, that thought was comforting. He thought of him sitting by the pool, soaking wet, crying and mumbling incoherently. McKnight spoke. Mitch, I'm afraid I neglected to cover something that should have been discussed during the first visit here. He waited and finally said, Okay, what is it? The partners watched McKnight intently. We've never allowed an associate to begin his career burdened with student loans. We prefer that you find other things to worry about and other ways to spend your money. How much do you owe? Mitch sipped his coffee and thought rapidly. Almost 23,000. Have the documents on Louise's desk, first thing in the morning.
You mean the firm satisfies the loans?
That's our policy, unless you object.
No objection. I don't quite know what to say.
You don't have to say anything. We've done it for every associate for the past 15 years. Just get the paperwork to Louise.
That's very generous, Mr. McKnight.
Yes, it is.
Avery Tolar talked incessantly as the limo moved slowly through the noontime traffic. Mitch reminded him of himself, he said. A poor kid from a broken home, raised by foster families throughout southwest Texas, then put on the streets after high school. He worked the night shift in a shoe factory to finance junior college. An academic scholarship to UTEP opened the door. He graduated with honors, applied to 11 law schools, and chose Stanford. He finished number 2 in his class and turned down offers from every big firm on the West Coast. He wanted to do tax work. Nothing but tax work. Oliver Lambert had recruited him 16 years ago, back when the firm had fewer than 30 lawyers. He had a wife and 2 kids, but said little about the family. He talked about money. His passion, he called it. The first million was in the bank. The second was 2 years away. At $400,000 a year gross, it wouldn't take long. His specialty was forming partnerships to purchase supertankers. He was the premier specialist in his field and worked at $300 an hour, 60, sometimes 70 hours a week. Mitch would start at $100 an hour
at least 5 hours a day until he passed the bar and got his license. Then 8 hours a day would be expected at $1.50 an hour. Billing was the lifeblood of the firm. Everything revolved around it. Promotions, raises, bonuses, survival, success, everything revolved around how well one was billing. Especially the new guys. The quickest route to a reprimand was to neglect the daily billing records. Avery could not remember such a reprimand. It was simply unheard of for a member of the firm to ignore his billing. The average for associates was $175 per hour. For partners, $300. Milligan got $400 an hour from a couple of his clients, and Nathan Locke once got $500 an hour for some tax work that involved swapping assets in several foreign countries. $500 an hour. Avery relished the thought and computed $500 per hour by 50 hours per week at 50 weeks per year. $1,250,000 a year. That's how you make money in this business. You get a bunch of lawyers working by the hour and you build a dynasty. The more lawyers you get, the more money the partners make. Don't ignore the billing, he warned. That's the first rule of survival. If there were no files to bill on, immediately report to his office. He had plenty. On the 10th day of each month, the partners review the prior month's billing during one of their exclusive luncheons. It's a big ceremony. Royce McKnight reads out each lawyer's name, then the total of his monthly billing. The competition among the partners is intense, but good-spirited. They're all getting rich, right? It's very motivational. As for the associates, nothing is said to the low man unless it's his second straight month. Oliver Lambert will say something in passing. No one has ever finished low for 3 straight months. Bonuses can be earned by associates for exorbitant billing. Partnerships are based on one's track record for generating fees. So don't ignore it, he warned again. It must always have priority. After the bar exam, of course. The bar exam was a nuisance, an ordeal that must be endured, a rite of passage, and nothing any Harvard man should fear. Just concentrate on the review courses, he said, and try to remember everything he had just learned in law school. The limo wheeled into a side street between two tall buildings and stopped in front of a small canopy that extended from the curb to a black metal door. Avery looked at his watch and said to the driver, "Be back at 2. 2 hours for lunch, thought Mitch. That's over $600 in billable time. What a waste. The Manhattan Club occupied the top floor of a 10-story office building, which had last been fully occupied in the early 50s. Avery referred to the structure as a dump, but was quick to point out that the club was the most exclusive lunch and dinner refuge in the city. It offered excellent food in an all-white, rich male, plush environment. Powerful lunches for powerful people. Bankers, lawyers, executives, entrepreneurs, a few politicians, and a few aristocrats. A gold-plated elevator ran nonstop past the deserted offices and stopped on the elegant 10th floor. The maitre d' called Mr. Tolar by name and asked about his good friends Oliver Lambert and Nathan Locke. He expressed sympathies for the loss of Mr. Kaczynski and Mr. Hodge. Avery thanked him and introduced the newest member of the firm. The favorite table was waiting in the corner. A courtly black man named Ellis delivered the menus. "The firm does not allow drinking at lunch," Avery said as he opened his menu. "I don't drink during lunch." "That's good. What'll you have?" "Tea with ice." "Iced tea for him," Avery said to the waiter. "Bring me a Bombay martini on the rocks with 3 olives." Mitch bit his tongue and grinned behind the menu. We have too many rules, Avery mumbled.
The first martini led to a second, but he quit after two. He ordered for both of them. Broiled fish of some sort, the special of the day. He watched his weight carefully, he said. He also worked out daily at a health club, his own health club. He invited Mitch to come sweat with him, maybe after the bar exam. There were the usual questions about football in college and the standard denials of any greatness. Mitch asked about the children. He said they lived with their mother. The fish was raw and the baked potato was hard. Mitch picked at his plate, ate his salad slowly, and listened as his partner talked about most of the other people present for lunch. The mayor was seated at a large table with some Japanese. One of the firm's bankers was at the next table. There were some other big-shot lawyers and corporate types, all eating furiously and importantly, powerfully. The atmosphere was stuffy. According to Avery, every member of the club was a compelling figure, a potent force both in his field and in the city. Avery was at home. They both declined dessert and ordered coffee. He would be expected to be in the office by 9 each morning, Avery explained as he lit a Montesino. The secretaries would be there at 8:30. 9 to 5, but no one worked 8 hours a day. Personally, he was in the office by 8 and seldom left before 6. He could bill 12 hours each day, every day, regardless of how many hours he actually worked. 12 a day, 5 days a week, at $300 an hour for 50 weeks. $900,000 in billable time. That was his goal. Last year, he had billed $700,000, but there had been some personal problems. The firm didn't care if Mitch came in at 6 a.m. or 9 a.m. as long as the work was done.
What time are the doors unlocked? Mitch asked.
Everyone has a key, he explained, so he could come and go as he pleased. Security was tight, but the guards were accustomed to workaholics. Some of the work habits were legendary. Victor Milligan, in his younger days, worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, until he made partner. Then he quit working on Sundays. He had a heart attack and gave up Saturdays. His doctor put him on 10-hour days, 5 days a week, and he hasn't been happy since. Marty Kaczynski knew all the janitors by first name. He was a 9 a.m. man who wanted to have breakfast with the kids. He would come in at 9 and leave at midnight. Nathan Locke claims he can't work well after the secretaries arrive, so he comes in at 6. It would be a disgrace to start later. Here's a man 61 years old, worth $10 million, and works from 6 in the morning until 8 at night, 5 days a week, and then a half day on Saturday. If he retired, he'd die. Nobody punched a clock, the partner explained. Come and go as you please. Just get the work done. Mitch said he got the message. 16 hours a day would be nothing new. Avery complimented him on the new suit. There was an unwritten dress code, and it was apparent Mitch had caught on. He had a tailor, an old Korean in South Memphis he would recommend when Mitch could afford it. $1,500 a suit. Mitch said he would wait a year or two. An attorney from one of the bigger firms interrupted and spoke to Avery. He offered his sympathies and asked about the families. He and Joe Hodge had worked together on a case last year, and he couldn't believe it. Avery introduced him to Mitch. He was at the funeral, he said. They waited for him to leave, but he rambled on and on about how sorry he was. It was obvious he wanted details. Avery offered none, and he finally left. By 2, the power lunches were losing steam and the crowd thinned. Avery signed the check, and the maitre d' led them to the door. The chauffeur stood patiently by the rear of the limo.
Mitch crawled into the back and sank into the heavy leather seat. He watched the buildings and the traffic. He looked at the pedestrians scurrying along the hot sidewalks and wondered how many of them had seen the inside of a limo or the inside of the Manhattan Club. How many of them would be rich in 10 years? He smiled and felt good. Harvard was a million miles away. Harvard with no student loans. Kentucky was in another world. His past was forgotten. He had arrived. The decorator was waiting in his office. Avery excused himself and asked Mitch to be in his office in an hour to begin work. She had books full of office furniture and samples of everything. He asked for suggestions, listened with as much interest as he could muster, then told her he trusted her judgment and she could pick out whatever she felt was appropriate. She liked the solid cherry work desk, no drawers, burgundy leather wing chairs, and a very expensive oriental rug. Mitch said it was marvelous. She left, and he sat behind the old desk, one that looked fine and would have suited him, except that it was considered used and therefore not good enough for a new lawyer at Bendini, Lambert, and Locke. The office was 15 by 15, with 2 6-foot windows facing north and staring directly into the second floor of the old building next door. Not much of a view. With a strain, he could see a glimpse of the river to the northwest. The walls were sheetrock and bare. She had picked out some artwork. He determined that the ego wall would face the desk behind the wing chairs. The diplomas, etc., would have to be mounted and framed. The office was big for an associate, much larger than the cubby holes where the rookies were placed in New York and Chicago. It would do for a couple of years. Then on to one with a better view. Then a corner office, one of those power ones. Miss Nina Huff knocked on the door and introduced herself as the secretary. She was a heavyset woman of 45, and with one glance it was not difficult to understand why she was still single. With no family to support, it was evident she spent her money on clothes and makeup, all to no avail. Mitch wondered why she did not invest in a fitness counselor. She informed him forthrightly that she had been with the firm 8.5 years now and knew all there was to know about office procedure. If he had a question, just ask her. He thanked her for that. She had been in the typing pool and was grateful for the return to general secretarial duties. He nodded, as though he understood completely. She asked if he knew how to operate the dictating equipment. Yes, he said. In fact, the year before, he had worked for a 300-man firm on Wall Street, and that firm owned the very latest in office technology. But if he had a problem, he would ask her, he promised. "What's your wife's name?" she asked. "Why is that important?" he asked. "Because when she calls, I would like to know her name so that I can be real sweet and friendly to her on the phone." "Abby, how do you like your coffee?" "Black, but I'll fix it myself." "I don't mind fixing your coffee for you. It's part of the job." "I'll fix it myself." "All the secretaries do it." "If you ever touch my coffee, I'll see to it that you're sent to the mailroom to lick stamps." "We have an automated licker." "Do they lick stamps on Wall Street?" It was a figure of speech. "Well, I've memorized your wife's name, and we've settled the issue of coffee, so I guess I'm ready to start." "In the morning. Be here at 8:30. "Yes, boss." She left, and Mitch smiled to himself. She was a real smartass, but she would be fun. Lamar was next. He was late for a meeting with Nathan Locke, but he wanted to stop by and check on his friend. He was pleased their offices were close. He apologized again for last Thursday's dinner. Yes, he and Kay and the kids would be there at 7 to inspect the new house and the furniture. Hunter Quinn was 5. His sister Holly was 7. They both ate the spaghetti with perfect manners from the brand new dining table and dutifully ignored the grown-up talk circulating around them. Abby watched the two and dreamed of babies. Mitch thought they were cute, but was not inspired. He was busy recalling the events of the day. The women ate quickly, then left to look at the furniture and talk about the remodeling. The children took hearsay to the backyard. "I'm a little surprised they put you with Tolar," Lamar said, wiping his mouth. "Why is that?" "I don't think he's ever supervised an associate."
"Any particular reason?"
"Not really. He's a great guy, but not much of a team player. Sort of a loner. Prefers to work by himself. He and his wife are having some problems, and there's talk that they've separated. But he keeps it to himself." Mitch pushed his plate away and sipped the iced tea.
"Is he a good lawyer?"
"Yes, very good. They're all good if they make partner. A lot of his clients are rich people with millions to put in tax shelters. He sets up limited partnerships. Many of his shelters are risky, and he's known for his willingness to take chances and fight with the IRS later. Most of his clients are big-time risk-takers. He'll do a lot of research looking for ways to bend the tax laws. It'll be fun." He spent half of lunch lecturing on billing. "It's vital. There's always the pressure to bill more and more. All we have to sell is our time. Once you pass the bar, your billing will be monitored weekly by Tolar and Royce McKnight. It's all computerized, and they can tell down to the dime how productive you are. You'll be expected to bill 30 to 40 hours a week for the first 6 months, then 50 for a couple of years. Before they'll consider you for partner, you've got to hit 60 hours a week consistently over a period of years. No active partner bills less than 60 a week. Most of it at the maximum rate."
"That's a lot of hours."
"Sounds that way, but it's deceptive. Most good lawyers can work 8 or 9 hours a day and bill 12. It's called padding. It's not exactly fair to the client, but it's something everybody does. The great firms have been built by padding files. It's the name of the game."
"Sounds unethical."
"So is ambulance chasing by plaintiff's lawyers. It's unethical for a dope lawyer to take his fee in cash if he has a reason to believe the money is dirty. A lot of things are unethical. What about the doctor who sees 100 Medicare patients a day? Or the one who performs unnecessary surgery? Some of the most unethical people I've met have been my own clients. It's easy to pad a file when your client is a multimillionaire who wants to screw the government and wants you to do it legally. We all do it."
"Do they teach it?"
"No. You just sort of learn it. You'll start off working long, crazy hours, but you can't do it forever. So you start taking shortcuts. Believe me, Mitch, after you've been with us a year, you'll know how to work 10 hours and bill twice that much. It's sort of a sixth sense lawyers acquire."
"What else will I acquire?"
Lamar rattled his ice cubes and thought for a moment.
"A certain amount of cynicism. This business works on you. When you were in law school, you had some noble idea of what a lawyer should be. A champion of individual rights, a defender of the Constitution, a guardian of the oppressed, an advocate for your client's principles. Then after you practice for 6 months, you realize you're nothing but hired guns, mouthpieces for sale to the highest bidder, available to anybody, any crook, any sleazebag with enough money to pay our outrageous fees.
Nothing shocks you. It's supposed to be an honorable profession, but you'll meet so many crooked lawyers you'll want to quit and find an honest job.
Yeah, Mitch, you'll get cynical. And it's sad, really.
You shouldn't be telling me this at this stage of my career.
The money makes up for it. It's amazing how much drudgery you can endure at $200,000 a year.
Drudgery? You make it sound terrible.
I'm sorry. It's not that bad. My perspective on life changed radically last Thursday.
You want to look at the house? It's marvelous.
Maybe some other time. Let's just talk.
Chapter 6. At 5 a.m., the alarm clock exploded on the new bed table under the new lamp and was immediately silenced. Mitch staggered through the dark house and found Hearsay waiting at the back door. He released him into the backyard and headed for the shower. 20 minutes later, he found his wife under the covers and kissed her goodbye. She did not respond. With no traffic to fight, the office was 10 minutes away. He had decided his day would start at 5:30, unless someone could top that. Then he would be there at 5, or 4:30, or whenever it took to be first. Sleep was a nuisance. He would be the first lawyer to arrive at the Bendini building on this day and every day until he became a partner. If it took the others 10 years, he could do it in 7. He would become the youngest partner in the history of the firm, he had decided. The vacant lot next to the Bendini building had a 10-foot chain-link fence around it and a guard by the gate. There was a parking place inside with his name spray-painted between the yellow lines. He stopped by the gate and waited. The uniformed guard emerged from the darkness and approached the driver's door. Mitch pushed a button, lowered the window, and produced a plastic card with his picture on it.
"You must be the new man," the guard said as he held the card.
"Yes, Mitch McDear."
"I can read. I should have known by the car."
"What's your name?" Mitch asked.
"Dutch Hendricks. Worked for the Memphis Police Department for 33 years.
"Nice to meet you, Dutch."
"Yeah, same to you. You start early, don't you?"
Mitch smiled and took the ID card.
"No, I thought everyone would be here."
Dutch managed to smile.
"You're the first. Mr. Locke will be along shortly."
The gate opened and Dutch ordered him through. He found his name in white on the asphalt and parked the spotless BMW all by itself on the third row from the building. He grabbed his empty burgundy eel skin attaché case from the rear seat and gently closed the door. Another guard waited by the rear entrance. Mitch introduced himself and watched as the door was unlocked. He checked his watch. Exactly 5:30. He was relieved that this hour was early enough. The rest of the firm was still asleep. He flipped on the light switch in his office and laid the attaché case on the temporary desk. He headed for the coffee room down the hall, turning on lights as he went. The coffee pot was one of those industrial sizes with multi-levels, multi-burners, multi-pots, and no apparent instructions on how to operate any of it. He studied this machine for a moment as he emptied a pack of coffee into the filter. He poured water through one of the holes in the top and smiled when it began dripping in the right place. In one corner of his office were 3 cardboard boxes full of books, files, legal pads, and class notes he had accumulated in the previous 3 years. He set the first one on his desk and began removing its contents. The materials were categorized and placed in neat little piles around the desk. After 2 cups of coffee, he found the bar review materials in box number 3. He walked to the window and opened the blinds. It was still dark. He did not notice the figure suddenly appear in the doorway. "Good morning." Mitch spun from the window and gawked at the man. "You scared me," he said, and breathed deeply. "I'm sorry. I'm Nathan Locke. I don't believe we've met." "I'm Mitch McDear, the new man." They shook hands. "Yes, I know. I apologize for not meeting you earlier. I was busy during your earlier visits. I think I saw you at the funerals Monday." Mitch nodded and knew for certain he had never been within 100 yards of Nathan Locke. He would have remembered. It was the eyes. The cold, black eyes with layers of black wrinkles around them. Great eyes. Unforgettable eyes. His hair was white and thin on top with thickets around the ears, and the whiteness contrasted sharply with the rest of his face. When he spoke, the eyes narrowed and the black pupils glowed fiercely. Sinister eyes. Knowing eyes. "Maybe so," Mitch said, captivated by the most evil face he had ever encountered. "Maybe so. I see you're an early riser."
"Yes, sir."
"Well, good to have you." Nathan Locke withdrew from the doorway and disappeared. Mitch checked the hall, then closed the door. No wonder they keep him on the fourth floor, away from everyone, he thought. Now he understood why he didn't meet Nathan Locke before he signed on. He might have had second thoughts. Probably hid him from all the prospective recruits. He had, without a doubt, the most ominous, evil presence Mitch had ever felt. "It was the eyes," he said to himself again, as he propped his feet on the desk and sipped coffee. "The eyes." As Mitch expected, Nina brought food when she reported at 8:30. She offered Mitch a donut, and he took two. She inquired as to whether she should bring enough food every morning, and Mitch said he thought it would be nice of her. "What's that?" she asked, pointing at the stacks of files and notes on the desk.
"That's our project for the day. We need to get this stuff organized."
"No dictating?"
"Not yet. I meet with Avery in a few minutes. I need this mess filed away in some order."
"How exciting," she said as she headed for the coffee room.
Avery Tolar was waiting with a thick, expandable file, which he handed to Mitch.
"This is the Capps file. Part of it. Our client's name is Sonny Capps. He lives in Houston now, but grew up in Arkansas. Worth about $30 million, keeps his thumb on every penny of it. His father gave him an old barge line just before he died, and he turned it into the largest towing service on the Mississippi River. Now he has ships, or boats, as he calls them, all over the world. We do 80% of his legal work, everything but the litigation. He wants to set up another limited partnership to purchase another fleet of tankers, this one from the family of some dead chink in Hong Kong. Capps is usually the general partner, and he'll bring in as many as 25 limited partners to spread the risk and pool their resources. This deal is worth about $65 million. I've done several limited partnerships for him, and they're all different, all complicated. And he is extremely difficult to deal with. He's a perfectionist and thinks he knows more than I do. You will not be talking to him. In fact, no one here talks to him but me. That file is a portion of the last partnership I did for him. It contains, among other things, a prospectus, an agreement to form a partnership, letters of intent, disclosure statements, and the limited partnership agreement itself. Read every word of it. Then I want you to prepare a rough draft of the partnership agreement for this venture. The file suddenly grew heavier. Perhaps 5:30 was not early enough. The partner continued.
We have about 40 days, according to Caps, so we're already behind. Marty Kaczynski was helping with this one, and as soon as I review his file, I'll give it to you. Any questions?
What about the research?
Most of it is current, but you'll need to update it. Caps earned over $9 million last year and paid a pittance in taxes. He doesn't believe in paying taxes and holds me personally responsible for every dime that's sent in. It's all legal, of course, but my point is that this is high-pressure work. Millions of dollars in investment and tax savings are at stake. The venture will be scrutinized by the governments of at least three countries. So be careful. Mitch flipped through the documents.
How many hours a day do I work on this?
As many as possible. I know the bar exam is important, but so is Sonny Caps. He paid us almost $500,000 last year in legal fees.
I'll get it done.
I know you will. As I told you, your rate is $100 an hour. Nina will go over the time records with you today. Remember, don't ignore the billing.
How could I forget?
Oliver Lambert and Nathan Locke stood before the metal door on the fifth floor and stared at the camera above. Something clicked loudly and the door opened. A guard nodded. Devasher waited in his office.
Good morning, Ollie, he said quietly while ignoring the other partner.
What's the latest? Locke snapped in Devasher's direction without looking at him.
From where? Devasher asked calmly.
Chicago.
They're very anxious up there, Nat. Regardless of what you believe, they don't like to get their hands dirty. And frankly, they just don't understand why they have to.
What do you mean?
They're asking some tough questions, like why can't we keep our people in line?
And what are you telling them?
That everything's okay. Wonderful. The great Bendini firm is solid. The leaks have been plugged. Business as usual. No problems.
How much damage did they do? Asked Oliver Lambert.
We're not sure. We'll never be sure, but I don't think they ever talked.
They had decided to, no doubt about that. But I don't think they did.
We've got it from a pretty good source. There were FBI agents en route to the island the day of the accident, so we think they planned a rendezvous to spill their guts.
How do you know this? Asked Locke.
Come on, Nat. We've got our sources. Plus, we had people all over the island. We do good work, you know.
Evidently.
Was it messy?
No. Very professional.
How'd the native get in the way?
We had to make it look good, Ollie.
What about the authorities down there?
What authorities? It's a tiny, peaceful island, Ollie. Last year they had one murder and four diving accidents. As far as they're concerned, it's just another accident. Three accidental drownings.
What about the FBI? Asked Locke.
Don't know.
I thought you had a source.
We do, but we can't find him. We've heard nothing as of yesterday. Our people are still on the island, and they've noticed nothing unusual.
How long will you stay there?
A couple of weeks.
What happens if the FBI shows up? Asked Locke.
We watch them real close. We'll see them when they get off the plane. We'll follow them to their hotel rooms. We may even bug their phones. We'll know what they eat for breakfast and what they talk about. We'll assign three of our guys for every one of theirs, and when they go to the toilet, we'll know it. There ain't nothing for them to find, Nat. I told you, it was a clean job, very professional. No evidence. Relax.
This makes me sick, Devasher, Lambert said.
You think I like it, Ollie? What do you want us to do? Sit back and let them talk?
Come on, Ollie. We're all human.
I didn't want to do it, but Lazarov said, do it. You want to argue with Lazarov, go ahead. They'll find you floating somewhere. Those boys were up to no good. They should have kept quiet, driven their little fancy cars, and played big-shot lawyers. No, they gotta get sanctimonious.
Nathan Locke lit a cigarette and blew a heavy cloud of smoke in the general direction of Devasher. The three sat in silence for a moment as the smoke settled across his desk. He glared at black eyes but said nothing. Oliver Lambert stood and stared at the blank wall next to the door.
"Why did you want to see us?" he asked.
Devasher took a deep breath.
"Chicago wants to bug the home phones of all non-partners."
"I told you," Lambert said to Locke.
"It wasn't my idea, but they insist on it. They're very nervous up there, and they want to take some extra precautions. You can't blame them."
"Don't you think it's going a bit too far?" asked Lambert.
"Yeah, it's totally unnecessary. But Chicago doesn't think so."
"When?" asked Locke.
"Next week or so. It'll take a few days."
"All of them?"
"Yes, that's what they said."
"Even McDear?"
"Yes, even McDear. I think Terrence will try again, and he might start at the bottom this time."
"I met him this morning," said Locke. "He was here before me."
5:32, answered Devasher.
The law school memorabilia were removed to the floor and the caps file spread across the desk. Nina brought a chicken salad sandwich back from lunch, and he ate it as he read and as she filed away the junk on the floor. Shortly after 1, Wally Hudson, or J. Walter Hudson, as the firm letterhead declared him, arrived to begin the study for the bar exam. Contracts were his specialty. He was a 5-year member of the firm and the only Virginia man, which he found odd because Virginia had the best law school in the country, in his opinion. He had spent the last 2 years developing a new review course for the contracts section of the exam. He was quite anxious to try it on someone, and McDear happened to be the man. He handed Mitch a heavy 3-ring notebook that was at least 4 inches thick and weighed as much as the caps file. The exam would last for 4 days and consist of 3 parts, Wally explained. The first day would be a 4-hour multiple-choice exam on ethics. Gil Vaughn, one of the partners, was the resident expert on ethics and would supervise that portion of the review. The second day would be an 8-hour exam known simply as multi-state. It covered most areas of the law common to all states. It, too, was multiple-choice, and the questions were very deceptive. Then the heavy action. Days 3 and 4 would be 8 hours each and cover 15 areas of substantive law. Contracts, uniform commercial code, real estate, torts, domestic relations, wills, estates, taxation, workers' compensation, constitutional law, federal trial procedure, criminal procedure, corporations, partnerships, insurance, and debtor-creditor relations. All answers would be in essay form, and the questions would emphasize Tennessee law. The firm had a review plan for each of the 15 sections.
"You mean 15 of these?" Mitch asked as he lifted the notebook.
Wally smiled.
"Yes. We're very thorough. No one in this firm has ever flunked."
I know. I won't be the first.
"You and I will meet at least once a week for the next 6 weeks to go through the materials. Each session will last about 2 hours, so you can plan accordingly. I would suggest each Wednesday at 3.
"Morning or afternoon?"
"Afternoon."
"That's fine.
As you know, contracts and the Uniform Commercial Code go hand in hand, so I've incorporated the UCC into those materials. We'll cover both, but it'll take more time.
The typical bar exam is loaded with commercial transactions. Those problems make great essay questions, so that notebook will be very important. I've included actual questions from old exams along with the model answers. It's fascinating reading. I can't wait. Take the first 80 pages for next week. You'll find some essay questions you'll need to answer.
You mean homework?
Absolutely. I'll grade it next week. It's very important to practice these questions each week. This could be worse than law school. It's much more important than law school. We take it very seriously. We have a committee to monitor your progress from now until you sit for the exam. We'll be watching very closely.
Who's on the committee?
Myself, Avery Tolar, Royce McKnight, Randall Dunbar, and Kendall Mahon. We'll meet each Friday to assess your progress.
Wally produced a smaller, letter-sized notebook and laid it on the desk.
This is your daily log. You are to record the hours spent studying for the exam and the subjects studied. I'll pick it up every Friday morning before the committee meets. Any questions?
I can't think of any, Mitch said as he laid the notebook on top of the CAPS file.
Good. See you next Wednesday at 3. Less than 10 seconds after he left, Randall Dunbar walked in with a thick notebook remarkably similar to the one left behind by Wally. In fact, it was identical, but not quite as thick. Dunbar was head of real estate and had handled the purchase and sale of the McDear home in May. He handed Mitch the notebook, labeled Real Estate Law, and explained how his specialty was the most critical part of the exam.
Everything goes back to property, he said.
He had carefully prepared the materials himself over the past 10 years and confessed that he had often thought of publishing them as an authoritative work on property rights and land financing. He would need at least 1 hour a week, preferably on Tuesday afternoon. He talked for an hour about how different the exam was 30 years ago when he took it. Kendall Mahon added a new twist. He wanted to meet on Saturday mornings.
Early. Say 7:30.
No problem, Mitch said as he took the notebook and placed it next to the others. This one was for constitutional law, a favorite of Kendall's, although he seldom got to use it, he said. It was the most important section of the exam, or at least it had been when he took it 5 years ago. He had published an article on First Amendment rights in the Columbia Law Review in his senior year there. A copy of it was in the notebook in case Mitch wanted to read it. He promised to do so almost immediately. The procession continued throughout the afternoon until half the firm had stopped by with notebooks, assignments of homework, and requests for weekly meetings. No fewer than 6 reminded him that no member of the firm had ever failed the bar exam. When his secretary said goodbye at 5, the small desk was covered with enough bar review materials to choke a 10-man firm. Unable to speak, he simply smiled at her and returned to Wally's version of contract law. Food crossed his mind an hour later. Then, for the first time in 12 hours, he thought of Abby. He called her.
I won't be home for a while, he said.
But I'm cooking dinner.
Leave it on the stove, he said, somewhat shortly. There was a pause.
When will you be home? She asked with slow, precise words.
In a few hours.
A few hours. You've already been there half the day.
That's right, and I've got much more to do.
But it's your first day.
He wouldn't believe it if I told you.
Are you all right?
I'm fine. I'll be home later.
The starting engine awakened Dutch Hendricks, and he jumped to his feet. The gate opened and he waited by it as the last car left the lot. It stopped next to him.
Evening, Dutch, Mitch said. You just now leaving?
Yeah. Busy day.
Dutch flashed his light at his wrist and checked the time. 11:30.
Well, be careful, Dutch said.
Yeah. See you in a few hours.
The BMW turned onto Front Street and raced away into the night.
A few hours, thought Dutch. The rookies were indeed amazing. 18, 20 hours a day, 6 days a week, sometimes 7. They all planned to be the world's greatest lawyer and make $1 million overnight. Sometimes they worked around the clock, slept at their desks. He had seen it all. But they couldn't last. The human body was not meant for such abuse. After about 6 months, they lost steam. They would cut back to 15 hours a day, 6 days a week. Then 5.5. Then 12 hours a day. No one could work 100 hours a week for more than 6 months.
Chapter 7. One secretary dug through a file cabinet in search of something Avery needed immediately. The other secretary stood in front of his desk with a steno pad, occasionally writing down the instructions he gave when he stopped yelling into the receiver of his phone and listened to whoever was on the other end. 3 red lights were blinking on the phone. When he spoke into the receiver, the secretaries spoke sharply to each other. Mitch walked slowly into the office and stood by the door.
"Quiet!" Avery yelled to the secretaries.
The one in the file cabinet slammed the drawer and went to the next file cabinet, where she bent over and pulled the bottom drawer. Avery snapped his fingers at the other one and pointed at his desk calendar. He hung up without saying goodbye. "What's my schedule for today?" he asked while pulling a file from his credenza. 10 a.m. meeting with the IRS downtown. 1 p.m. meeting with Nathan Locke on the Spinoza file. 3:30, partners meeting. Tomorrow you're in tax court all day, and you're supposed to prepare all day today.
Great. Cancel everything. Check the flights to Houston Saturday afternoon and the return flights Monday, early Monday.
Yes, sir.
Mitch, where's the CAPS file?
On my desk.
How much have you done?
I've read through most of it.
We need to get in high gear. That was Sonny Capps on the phone. He wants to meet Saturday morning in Houston, and he wants a rough draft of the limited partnership agreement.
Mitch felt a nervous pain in his empty stomach. If he recalled correctly, the agreement was 140-some pages long.
Just a rough draft, Avery said as he pointed to a secretary.
No problem, Mitch said, with as much confidence as he could muster. It may not be perfect, but I'll have a rough draft.
I need it by noon Saturday, as perfect as possible. I'll get one of my secretaries to show Nina where the form agreements are in the memory bank. That will save some dictation and typing. I know this is unfair, but there's nothing fair about Sonny Capps. He's very demanding. He told me the deal must close in 20 days or it's dead. Everything is waiting on us.
I'll get it done.
Good. Let's meet at 8 in the morning to see where we are.
Avery punched one of the blinking lights and began arguing into the receiver. Mitch walked to his office and looked for the CAPS file under the 15 notebooks. Nina stuck her head in the door.
Oliver Lambert wants to see you.
When? Mitch asked.
As soon as you can get there.
Mitch looked at his watch. 3 hours at the office and he was ready to call it a day.
Can it wait?
I don't think so.
Mr. Lambert doesn't usually wait for anybody.
I see.
You better go.
What does he want?
His secretary didn't say.
He put on his coat, straightened his tie, and raced upstairs to the 4th floor where Mr. Lambert's secretary was waiting. She introduced herself and informed him she had been with the firm for 31 years. In fact, she was the 2nd secretary hired by Mr. Anthony Bendini after he moved to Memphis. Ida Renfro was her name, but everyone called her Mrs. Ida.
She showed him into the big office and closed the door. Oliver Lambert stood behind his desk and removed his reading glasses. He smiled warmly and laid his pipe in the brass holder. "Good morning, Mitch," he said softly, as if time meant nothing. "Let's sit over there." He waved to the sofa. "Would you like coffee?" Mr. Lambert asked. "No, thanks." Mitch sank into the couch, and the partner sat in a stiff wing chair, 2 feet away and 3 feet higher. Mitch unbuttoned his coat and tried to relax. He crossed his legs and glanced at his new pair of Cole Haans. $200. That was an hour's work for an associate at this money-printing factory. He tried to relax, but he could feel the panic in Avery's voice and see the desperation in his eyes when he held the phone and listened to this Caps fellow on the other end. This, his second full day on the job, and his head was pounding and his stomach hurting. Mr. Lambert smiled downward with his best, sincere, grandfatherly smile. It was time for a lecture of some sort. He wore a brilliant white shirt, button-down, all cotton, pinpoint, with a small, dark silk bow tie which bestowed upon him a look of extreme intelligence and wisdom. As always, he was tanned beyond the usual midsummer Memphis scorched bronzeness. His teeth sparkled like diamonds. A 60-year-old model. "Just a couple of things, Mitch," he said. "I understand you've become quite busy."
"Yes, sir, quite."
"Panic is a way of life in a major law firm, and clients like Sonny Capps can cause ulcers. Our clients are our only assets, so we kill ourselves for them." Mitch smiled and frowned at the same time. "Two things, Mitch. First, my wife and I want you and Abby to have dinner with us Saturday. We dine out quite often, and we enjoy having our friends with us. I am somewhat of a chef myself, and I appreciate fine food and drink. We usually reserve a large table at one of our favorite restaurants in town, invite our friends, and spend the evening with a 9-course meal and the rarest of wines. Will you and Abby be free on Saturday?"
"Of course."
"Kendall Mayen, Wally Hudson, Lamar Quinn, and their wives will also be there."
"We'd be delighted."
"Good. My favorite place in Memphis is Justine's. It's an old French restaurant with exquisite cuisine and an impressive wine list. Say 7 Saturday.
We'll be there."
"Second, there's something we need to discuss. I'm sure you're aware of it, but it's worth mentioning. It's very important to us. I know they taught you at Harvard that there exists a confidential relationship between yourself as a lawyer and your client. It's a privileged relationship, and you can never be forced to divulge anything a client tells you. It's strictly confidential. It's a violation of our ethics if we discuss our client's business. Now, this applies to every lawyer, but at this firm, we take this professional relationship very seriously. We don't discuss a client's business with anyone. Not other lawyers. Not spouses. Sometimes not even each other. As a rule, we don't talk at home, and our wives have learned not to ask. The less you say, the better off you are. Mr. Bendini was a great believer in secrecy, and he taught us well. You will never hear a member of this firm mention even so much as a client's name outside this building. That's how serious we are. Where's he going with this? Mitch asked himself. Any second-year law student could give this speech.
I understand that, Mr. Lambert, and you don't have to worry about me.
Loose tongues lose lawsuits. That was Mr. Bendini's motto, and he applied it to everything. We simply do not discuss our client's business with anyone, and that includes our wives.
We are very quiet, very secretive, and we like it that way. You'll meet other lawyers around town, and sooner or later they'll ask,